I want us this evening to sit in as spectators on the events of Joshua chapter 22. And you won't need me to tell you much by way of background. On the whole, things had gone extremely well. Israel's holy war, or I suppose better, the war of the Lord, which lasted about 7 years, was now more or less over. Israel had successfully invaded the land of Canaan, and they'd broken the backbone of the nations which dwelt there. The Canaanite forces were now significantly weakened, they were scattered, they were dispirited, and all that was left was a mopping up operation, or so it should have been. The 2.5 tribes had earlier settled on the east of Jordan with Moses' permission. So we read in verse 4 of our chapter, "Of the land of your possession, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you on the other side of the Jordan." This particular territory had once belonged to two pagan kings, to Sihon, king of the Amorites, and a rather large gentleman from Bashan, graced by his parents with the enchanting name of Og. Both kings had been roundly defeated, and the land that they had once ruled now belonged to the 2.5 tribes. The 2.5 tribes had agreed with Moses that they would go armed for war before the Lord, before the children of Israel, that is, to battle, an expression occurring in one form or another 7 times in the book of Numbers chapter 32. And according to Joshua chapter 1, 3 days before Israel crossed the Jordan to confront the Canaanite nations, Joshua had therefore drafted the 2.5 tribes in on a temporary basis for the duration then unspecified of the Canaan campaign. He held them to their earlier promise, saying, "You shall pass before your brethren armed, all your mighty men of valor, and help them," which met with their ready response, "All that you command us, we will do, and wherever you send us, we will go." And they were as good as their word. They did just that. Not only fighting under the national banner, but according to chapter 4, leading the way both across the Jordan and into the plain of Jericho. And now the war was virtually over. The 2.5 tribes were given an honorable discharge, blessed and dismissed. Our story begins properly after the 2.5 tribes had left the rest of the nation at Shiloh and had reached their own territory on the other side of the Jordan. So, let's read the inspired account of what happened then. "And when they came to the region of the Jordan that is in the land of Canaan, the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh built there an altar by the Jordan, an altar of grand appearance. And the children of Israel heard it said, 'Behold, the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh have built an altar in front of the land of Canaan, near the region of the Jordan, near the region of the children of Israel.' And when the children of Israel heard of it, the whole assembly of the children of Israel gathered together at Shiloh to make war against them. Then the children of Israel sent to the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, and with him 10 chiefs, of each father's house a chief,
out of all the tribes of Israel. And they came to the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, in the land of Gilead, and spoke with them, saying, Thus says the whole assembly of the Lord, What is this trespass which you have trespassed against the God of Israel in turning away this day from following the Lord, in that you have built yourselves an altar this day in rebellion against the Lord? Is the iniquity of Peor too little for us, that you must turn away this day from following the Lord? And it will be that if you rebel against the Lord today, then tomorrow he will be angry with the whole assembly of Israel. Howbeit, if the land of your possession is unclean, pass over into the land of the Lord's possession, where the Lord's tabernacle stands, and take possession among us. But do not rebel against the Lord, or rebel against us, by building for yourselves an altar other than the altar of the Lord our God. Did not Achan, the son of Zerah, commit a trespass in the devoted thing? And wrath fell upon all the assembly of Israel, and he did not perish alone because of his iniquity. Then the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh said in answer to the heads of the thousands in Israel, The Lord, the God of gods, the Lord, the God of gods, he knows, and Israel itself shall know. If it was in rebellion or in trespass against the Lord, save us not this day, that we have built an altar to turn away from following the Lord, or if it is to offer burnt offerings, grain offerings, or peace offerings on it, let the Lord himself require it. But we have done it from fear, that in time to come your children may say to our children, Now what have you to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? For the Lord has made the Jordan a boundary between us and you, you children of Reuben and children of Gad. You have no portion in the Lord. Therefore, we say, let us now build an altar, not for burnt offering nor for sacrifice, but to be a witness between us and you, and between our generations after us, so that your children may not say to our children in time to come, You have no portion in the Lord. And we said, If this should be said to us or to our future generations, we will say, Behold, the pattern of the altar of the Lord which our fathers made, not for burnt offering, nor for sacrifice, but as a witness between us and you. Far be it from us that we should rebel against the Lord, and turn away this day from following the Lord by building an altar for burnt offering, grain offering, or sacrifice other than the altar of the Lord our God that is before his tabernacle. And when Phinehas the priest and the chiefs of the assembly heard the words which the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the children of Manasseh spoke, it was good in their eyes. And Phinehas said to the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the children of Manasseh, This day we know that the Lord is among us, because you have not committed this trespass against the Lord. Now you have delivered the children of Israel out of the hand of the Lord. And Phinehas and the chiefs returned out of the land of Gilead to the land of Canaan to the children of Israel, and brought back word to them. And the report was good in the eyes of the children of Israel. And the children of Israel blessed God, spoke no more of making war against them to destroy the land where the children of Reuben and the children of Gad dwell. Well, clearly some keen-sighted individual in Israel observed that having reached their own territory on the other side of the Jordan, the 2.5 tribes immediately set about erecting an altar, and some altar it was, an altar of grand appearance, and literally it was an altar great to sight. The man who spotted this impressive altar was horrified. He raced off to Shiloh to spread the disturbing news, but then he didn't know what lay behind the action of the 2.5 tribes. He didn't know their purpose and intention when they built the altar, but we do. Because we've had the benefit of having read verses 21 to 29. After they left the 9.5 tribes at Shiloh, the 2.5 tribes had been forced to do some very hard thinking. It had not been easy getting home because of the geographical layout of the area. The Jordan River ran through a deep valley about 1,300 feet below sea level, and on either side, mountain plateaus rose about 2,000 feet above sea level, and this 3,500 foot gorge formed a very daunting natural boundary, as the 2.5 tribes describe it. As they made their way home, the 2.5 tribes became increasingly concerned that a future generation of the 9.5 tribes, encouraged by that natural boundary, would disown any link, any association with their descendants. They concluded that their own children would need some very convincing argument if they were ever to satisfy the descendants of the 9.5 tribes that they did, in fact, serve the same God and that they formed part of the same nation. But with what persuasive evidence could they possibly provide their children? And then someone had a brainwave. They would build an altar, but not just any altar. Not an altar built to their design or specification, certainly not. They would build an altar, as later made clear in verse 28, according to the pattern of the Lord's altar at Shiloh. It would be a replica, it would be a facsimile, an exact copy of that altar. The idea was nothing short of brilliant, because the altar at the tabernacle at Shiloh was the very center and the focus for the life of Israel. All males in Israel were required to visit God's dwelling place there 3 times every year. Everyone was familiar, therefore, with the pattern of the altar. In any case, the idea of building monuments as a reminder of some great event or of something else was well understood. This would be number 6 in the book, and as in the case of the first, the 12 stones taken out of the Jordan near Gilgal, this altar would be for the benefit and the education of their children. Their altar was to serve as silent evidence that the 2.5 tribes were indeed part and parcel of the nation. There was no question of the altar ever being used for sacrifice and offering, such as were the altars linked to the golden calves set up some 470 years later by Jeroboam at Bethel and Dan. Perish the thought. Nothing could have been further from their minds. Their altar would never feel the heat of a flame, never bear the weight of a sacrificial victim. Indeed, as we read later,
They were absolutely horrified at the very idea, as witness. They repeated their emphatic denials. 4 times they insist that it was not for burnt offering or sacrifice. Ah, from it being a rival altar, it would simply be a memorial altar to serve as a symbol of the unity of the nation, acting, metaphorically speaking, as a bridge over the Jordan. The altar would be, and was, therefore deliberately built where it was, clearly visible to the tribes on the other side of the Jordan, and was deliberately built on a larger scale than the altar at Shiloh. Why else should far fewer people want a bigger altar? Obviously they wanted it to be seen from a distance. And if in the future some bright spark from the other side said, "You're nothing to do with us," their children had only to respond, "Would you mind coming and having a look at this altar then? Where do you think our fathers got this design from?" But it was not only a brilliant idea, it was a highly commendable idea, because it was the very first thing they set about doing on their return home. It showed their very real concern, both for the future of God's work and for the spiritual well-being of generations to come. Their priority was not to erect some great monument to commemorate their own recent exploits in the forefront of the many battles in Canaan. What tales these men must have had to tell! Nor was their first priority to enjoy their possessions. Back in chapter 1, Joshua had promised that when the Lord had given rest to all the tribes of Israel following the Canaan campaign, the 2.5 tribes could return to their possession and enjoy it. And now the Lord had given rest to the whole of Israel, a point made 3 times from chapter 11 to chapter 22. And so they, the 2.5 tribes, were entitled not only to return to their inheritance, but indeed there to enjoy it. Nor was their first priority to share their spoil with those who had remained at home. Even though Joshua had explicitly spoken of their plunder in terms of very large quantities of cattle and of silver, gold, bronze, iron, and very much clothing, and had told them to divide this rich booty with their brethren. Nor was their first priority to celebrate their return to their families with a time of comfort and of ease. We do need to remember they had been away from home for no less than 7 years. What welcome home parties must have been waiting. They'd been the first tribes to have their inheritance allotted to them, but they were the last to enjoy it. They'd once promised Moses, "We will not return to our homes until every one of the children of Israel has received his inheritance." And they were men of their word. But now that they had finally made it home, top of the list, their very first priority was to build this altar. Full marks to them. But then came their mistake. And it was a colossal mistake. They didn't tell anyone else what they had in mind. True, they were able to report later that at the time they had said, but this, please note, was only among themselves.
They didn't breathe a word to Joshua, to Phinehas, or to anyone else from the 9.5 tribes about what they were proposing, or for the reason for it. Why was this? We might wonder. Too much effort to go back across the Jordan? No, I don't think so. I think it more likely they found it too embarrassing an issue to raise with their brethren, because their very concern could easily have been interpreted as calling in question the spirituality of the 9.5 tribes, either in terms of the adequacy of the education which the fathers would give to their children about the identity of the 2.5 tribes over there, or in terms of their children's understanding and grasp of this. It would certainly have been a rather delicate matter to raise, but their failure to come out into the open and to discuss it was highly dangerous and proved almost totally disastrous. They were taking an action which, if they cared to think about it, was, to say the least, open to easy misunderstanding. Well, the man who'd first spied the altar scurried off to Shiloh, where the news was received with great consternation. In no time, the 9.5 tribes were up in arms, literally up in arms. The whole assembly of the children of Israel gathered together to make war against them. Now, in one way, this was commendable zeal for God's honor and the purity of his worship, coming as it did from the children of those who had once worshipped the molten calf. Israel had come a long way since then. At least they were prepared to address the problem. They didn't ignore it as of no importance or attempt to sweep it under the carpet. They cared sufficiently about the future of the testimony that they were willing to risk their lives in battle. And that after only recently concluding a 7-year Canaan campaign. The problem was that without realizing it, they had jumped to an unwarranted conclusion. But then to them, everything seemed so cut and dried. After all, what could an altar be for, if not for sacrifice and for worship? Obviously the 2.5 tribes weren't planning to invite them to a barbecue. From the words of verse 19, if the land of your possession is unclean, it seems that the 9.5 tribes assumed that the 2.5 tribes had come for some reason to view their inheritance as somehow defiled, and so planned to cleanse and sanctify it by means of sacrifice. But that would be, in effect, rebellion and trespass against the Lord, and this not only because they, the nation, had been directed by God to destroy all foreign altars, but because it would be a clear violation of the Lord's commandment that when he gave them rest from all their enemies round about, all offering and sacrifice was to be centralized in the one and only acceptable place, in the place which the Lord God chose. Now, the Lord had indeed given rest to all 12 tribes. It followed that they, the people, were therefore now to offer no sacrifices other than at the central sanctuary, at this time the tabernacle located at Shiloh. It therefore seemed clear to the 9.5 tribes that either the 2.5 tribes had forsaken the Lord for another god or gods, or they were introducing division, schism, into the worship and service of the one true God. Either way, to set up a rival worship center was an act of blatant apostasy Nine and a half tribes knew their Bibles. And they were determined to be loyal to the word of God. But without realizing it, the nine and a half tribes were reading an awful lot into the little that they knew. Spiritual wisdom would have dictated a very different procedure. The first step should have been to establish the facts, to check out the rumor. For the Spirit of God emphasizes that at this stage all was based on hearsay. They heard it said. Yes, in this case the rumor happened to be true, but it might easily not have been. Many a brother or sister's reputation has been smeared and tarnished in our day by false or exaggerated reports. The second step should have been to pray. According to verse 12, the assembly of Israel met at Shiloh, where the tabernacle of meeting was situated. And verse 13 stresses that Phinehas was the son of Eleazar. That is, he was the son of the then high priest who enjoyed the facility of the breastplate with its Urim and Thummim, by which he was able to discern the will of God for the people. Indeed, according to Numbers 27, Moses had said of Joshua, I got that right now, yes. Moses had said of Joshua, get it right, he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall ask counsel for him after the judgment of Urim before the Lord. You would have thought, therefore, that the nine and a half tribes would have availed themselves of the golden opportunity which this gave them. Surely they should have learned from the bruising they'd received back in chapter 9 in connection with the Gibeonites. The Gibeonites were those Canaanites who'd fooled Joshua and Israel with their dry and moldy bread, their rent wine bottles, and their old garments and shoes. Appearances had been deceptive, and Israel had burnt their fingers badly, and this we are told because they did not ask counsel from the Lord. In chapter 9 they had spared those whom they ought not. Now they came perilously close to annihilating those whom they ought not. The third step should have been to seek an explanation, and then, and only then, to take the fourth step, to decide on some appropriate course of action and discipline if necessary. Ah, but oh no, not Israel. To them everything was so straightforward and plain, and their knee-jerk reaction was to issue a call to arms, and in next to no time the combined forces of the nine and a half tribes were poised to attack and to destroy the two and a half tribes, and according to verse 33, to devastate their land. You can almost hear them. If they're going to worship and sacrifice like Canaanites, they can jolly well perish like Canaanites. You would have thought that they would have recalled their brethren's past companionship and fellowship, that they would have taken account of the way in which all 12 tribes had stood shoulder to shoulder against a common foe until only a short time ago, that they would have reminded themselves that for 7 long years the two and a half tribes had kept all the commandments of Moses, Joshua, and the Lord.
When the Allies liberated Paris in 1944, church bells, silent throughout the 4 years of German occupation, rang out joyously across the city. But I read recently that no bells rang out from one church, Saint Philippe des Roses. The parish priest, Jean Muller, was inundated with calls from his parishioners wanting to know why, following an official radio announcement the church bells should be rung, their bells were silent in church on the following Sunday. Muller thanked all who had called him. He then added, "I should like to remind you of something you all forgot in your excitement that day. There are no bells in the belfry of Saint Philippe." I get that given it had been 4 years since any church bells had been heard in Paris, it's excusable that many of the parishioners have forgotten that there weren't any bells in their church. But the 9.5 tribes had no such excuse. And the way in which the 2.5 tribes had recently risked their lives in God's service should have alerted the 9.5 tribes to the fact that there was probably more to theirs than met the eye. And it's frightening just how fast the perilous situation developed. One moment, the 2.5 tribes returned home, showered with compliments and praise. Didn't get any chocolates, but that's about all. The next, they faced the threat of annihilation at the hand of Israel's very formidable war machine. Thankfully, the resolve of the 9.5 tribes to wipe out their brethren was followed by a moment's calm reflection. Deuteronomy 13 envisaged a very similar situation, albeit that of a city. If you hear that worthless men have drawn away the inhabitants of their city, saying, "Let us go and serve other gods," then you shall inquire and make search and ask diligently. And behold, if it be true and certain, then you hit them hard. The first step, therefore, should have been to conduct a careful investigation to establish if the story was true. Great pity the 9.5 tribes had not launched an investigation sooner than they did. It would have saved themselves a lot of trouble, a lot of embarrassment. But better late than never. And I note that they stood united in this proposed disciplinary action. Each tribe was represented by a man who commanded respect and in whom they all had confidence. These were men who were able, therefore, to speak on behalf of the whole assembly of the Lord. And I note that the 10 chiefs included a chief from the half-tribe of Manasseh in the west. The 9.5 tribes are not going to let family ties or family connections influence or interfere with their judgment. Yet even now, the delegation weren't going to find out whether their suspicions were correct. They weren't going to seek explanations. They took it for granted that they were in the right. They were going to sort their brethren out, to persuade them to mend their ways or else. Although I suppose we do need to give them the credit, at least for trying, albeit at the last moment, to conquer their brethren by words rather than by swords. But speaking of words, we can hardly miss the charming way the men on the delegation expressed themselves, revealing their terribly smug, arrogant attitude. Their opening words
What is this trespass?
Now, it set the tone for everything that followed. They were strong words indeed. In a space of just 4 verses, the delegation managed to accuse their brethren of trespass, treachery, breaking faith once, turning away from following the Lord twice, and of rebellion no less than 4 times. They charged them with wickedness to be classed with Peor, with, that is, the Baal worship and its associated orgies instigated once through the counsel of Balaam in the book of Numbers chapter 25. It is, I guess, not surprising that they referred to that particular incident. Firstly, Beth Peor had been in Moab. It was now in the possession of, you guessed, the 2.5 tribes. Secondly, it was then Phinehas, the head of the delegation, who had distinguished himself as the great defender of the faith, whose holy zeal had saved the whole nation from God's judgment. It was not surprising, therefore, surely, that Phinehas, now the spokesman, should refer back to the occasion. You can't help wondering if the good man even now carried a spear with him, ready to deal with the ringleader if he could identify him, just as he had once at Peor. Thirdly, the Baal-Peor incident was relatively recent, having come at the end of the wilderness wandering just prior to the 7-year Canaan campaign. It was therefore still very much alive in the memory of Israel. And fourthly, it was not only the last spiritual departure before Israel entered the land, it was one of the vilest, most heinous incidents ever to stain their history, meriting mention by the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Neither let us indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did. Separately, on the basis of their experience with Achan at the beginning of the conquest of Canaan, the 9.5 tribes were terrified that the whole nation would suffer as a result of the sin of the 2.5 tribes, for as they point out ominously in verse 20, Achan did not perish alone because of his iniquity. The delegation spoke, therefore, in terms of the 2.5 tribes rebelling against us as well as against the law. Hardly needs to be said that such words were not exactly calculated to endear them to the 2.5 tribes, nor pave the way for any speedy reconciliation. The delegation accused their brethren of trespass, of turning away from the Lord, of rebellion, just about every sin in the book. And yet, there was one redeeming feature in their message. It was heralded by the howbeit, or nevertheless, of verse 19. Because in spite of the atrocious sin which they then believed their brethren had committed, they made what amounted to an enormously generous, self-denying offer. They told the 2.5 tribes that they were welcome to come back across the Jordan, that they, the 9.5 tribes, were willing each to move over a bit to make room for them, meaning, of course, less territory for themselves. And yet chapters 13 to 21 had all been devoted to the account of how they had recently carved up and apportioned the land. And that dividing of the land had not proved at all easy. As it was, the tribes of Joseph, that's Ephraim and Manasseh, had complained that they didn't have enough space because they, a great people as they saw themselves, had been given only one lot and portion as their inheritance. Now, not that they got much sympathy from Joshua, even though he himself was from the tribe of Ephraim. "If you are a great people," he had responded, "then go up to the forest and clear the ground there where the giants were. And also drive out the Canaanites with their iron chariots in the valley." In effect, told them, "Stop moaning, get on with it." Yet now the 9.5 tribes stood ready to rip up all their maps and all their plans should it prove necessary to go back to the drawing board and start all over again. They were prepared to fall over backwards, as it were, to avoid any trouble and conflict. They cared so much about their future as God's people that they were prepared to forfeit their own possessions if it would help. Now, by the time we reach verse 20, the situation was highly explosive. Remember, it had all been one huge misunderstanding. Just imagine for a moment that we had been in the sandals of the 2.5 tribes, a group of our brethren, for whom we've previously done a great deal indeed, for whom we've even risked our lives. A group of our brethren suddenly storm in and without so much as a by your leave charge us with a catalogue of serious offences of which we are entirely innocent. How would we react? How did the 2.5 try? It was desperately important that they kept calm. One unwise, one hasty word would have sparked off a civil war, which would have made the battle with the tribe of Benjamin at the end of the book of Judges seem like some tea party. And it's nothing short of thrilling to know the calm, the composed way in which the 2.5 tribes responded to the broadside that they'd suffered. They didn't interrupt their brethren's lecture, even though it was no less painfully repetitive than it was plainly outrageous. When many of us would have been sorely tempted, I'm sure, to file a lawsuit for slander, they listened patiently. And when they were finally permitted to speak, when they were able to get a word in, they did not take their brethren to task for their lack of confidence in them. They didn't tell them to mind their own business and to skedaddle back across the Jordan. And yet they were clearly aghast at the charges leveled against them, as witness the forceful, the repeated calling on God as their witness. And in just two sentences, the 2.5 tribes rebut all three charges leveled against them. They point out that their only motive and intention had been to avoid, indeed, to guard against the very division they were now accused of causing. As the Greek Old Testament expresses it, "We've done this as a precaution against this very thing." Clearly, all 12 tribes were in agreement in fearing any division among the people of God. And the 2.5 tribes conclude with an expression of horror at the very thought of rebelling against the Lord. In the event, as a result of their courteous attitude and their detailed explanation, everything was sorted out amicably and peacefully. Initially, the delegation, and then subsequently the whole 9.5 tribes were fully satisfied that everything was all right after all. It was good in their eyes. So the chapter ends with Israel's God blessed
and Israel's swords sheathed. A disastrous feud had been averted. Israel had pulled back from the brink of disaster, but it had been a very close shave. So much for history. But we have it on the highest possible authority that these things happened to them by way of example. And they're written for our instruction since the days of Joshua. An incredible and an alarming amount of trouble, division, and misery has been caused by misunderstandings, by the failure to consider others and to consult with them, and by jumping to hasty conclusions. Would to God that all such differences and misunderstandings in our day could end as happily as did those in the days of Joshua. And to that end, let me collect the key lessons that we need to take home with us from this passage this evening. First, on the plus side, from the concern of the 2.5 tribes about the spiritual well-being of future generations, from their desire to maintain and to preserve the unity of God's people, from their first priority, not building any memorial for themselves or seeking their own comfort and enjoyment, the law came first. From the concern shown by the 9.5 tribes for the purity of the worship of the people of God, from their refusing to ignore an obvious problem, from their unity in their planned discipline, refusing to let family ties influence their actions, and from their willingness to suffer personal loss if this would further the interests of the people of God. But there were undoubtedly faults on both sides. From the 2.5 tribes, we learn that serious problems can arise from a breakdown in communication, from failing to inform others what's in mind when embarking on something different or new. From the 9.5 tribes, we see the danger of being ready to act on mere hearsay, of jumping to hasty conclusions, of ignoring the past faithful service of our brethren, and of speaking to others in a harsh, smug manner. But the end of the episode reflected credit on both sides. From the 2.5 tribes, we learn the importance of self-control, of being willing to hear out what others have to say before patiently explaining the true situation. And the 9.5 tribes can give us a much needed lesson in admitting our mistakes, not attempting to justify either ourselves or our own wrong actions. I leave the last word with the Apostle Paul. With all lowliness and meekness, with long suffering, bearing with one another in love, earnestly striving to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Shall we pray?